Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 8, 2014. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar are due to meet in Addis Ababa tomorrow, but will the meeting stop the bloodshed?
Kiir would like a situation whereby he leads the transition government and he remains the commander-in-chief, and how he wants to reconcile with this group and run the transition, then go to election.
And a new report says horrific atrocities are being committed by both sides during the five-month-long conflict in South Sudan.
The violations that have been committed include extrajudicial killings, include raping of women, include forced displacement of people, include destruction of property, includes far too much killing and torturing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar are set to meet in the Ethiopian capital for talks aimed at ending their country's five-month-old conflict. A rebel spokesman tells VOA that Machar, who has been in hiding, is already in Addis Ababa. Martha Vandoof has more from Ethiopia.
President Salva Kiir is expected in Addis Ababa on Friday to meet his former vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar. The men agreed to meet face-to-face this week after visits to Juba by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The spokesman of the rebel delegation, Gojo Yul, says it is a good sign the two leaders have agreed to meet each other.
And we are very glad that in the next few days, our principals, you know, Dr. Riek and Salva Kiir, will be meeting to give a push or a blessing to the ongoing peace process in Addis Ababa. Also, we would like to see them have a roadmap on how these things should proceed.
This week, the rebels and government agreed to a one-month truce to allow aid groups to reach affected communities and to allow farmers to plant their fields before the start of the rainy season. A ceasefire agreement was signed by both sides in late January, but has been repeatedly violated. Earlier this week, both sides recommitted to the cessation of hostilities deal after the United States imposed sanctions targeting leaders of both the government and the rebels. The sides also appear to agree on an agenda for the upcoming talks, including implementation of the ceasefire agreement, discussing a transitional government and a permanent constitution. But just one day after that agreement, South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, raised questions about some of the details.
We have not yet discussed with the rebels. We have not yet agreed with them on the establishment of a national unity government or a government of national unity. Then how dare we go in, how can we be told to discuss the task, the size, and the time frame? We are also required to talk about a transitional national legislative assembly. Have we agreed on the transitional period, or have we agreed to set up a transitional government for that matter?
The East African bloc IGAD has been mediating peace talks since the start of the conflict. The bloc says it expects a high-level meeting between Mr. Kiir and Machar will help end the violence and killings in South Sudan. Fighting that broke out in mid-December has left thousands dead and more than 1.3 million displaced from their homes. A possible famine is also looming as farmers have been unable to plant their fields due to the violence. If the fields are not planted by the end of May, there will be no harvest at the end of this year. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A regional security analyst says tomorrow's scheduled meeting between President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar is critical to bringing peace to South Sudan. David Poole Cole, a member of Civil Society Africa Security Sector Network, who has helped South Sudan with security reforms, tells Lucy Pony that a one-day meeting is not enough. But he says it will at least give the leaders time to voice support for the peace talks, which could help push to a successful conclusion.
He goes to this meeting thinking that if now he concedes, what guarantees are there that whatever they agree will be implemented? So trust is running very thin among the two groups. Secondly, there are pressures on both sides. For Machar, they need to take this war where it hurts the Kiri people most. So, and then for Kiri, where things are moving in now, the oil production is coming down and the revenues from oil are getting less and less. So if this continues and the oil production even stops, where do we get then the revenue to run the... So this thing must come to a stop. And also this thing must stop before it moves into Warap, into the Lake States. This thing must stop before the range.
With regards to a suggestion on the formation of an interim government to solve this problem, what do you think are the takes of the two leaders as they come together on this issue?
Kiir has established three or four committees already, and they are working on the ground. One, to focus on cessation of hostilities, the implementation of that. And if you realize that they have signed recently, the two-thirds area commitment, there's a committee working on transition government. So Kiir would like a situation whereby he leads the transition government and he remains the commander-in-chief, and how he wants to reconcile with this group and run the transition, then go to election. So in my view, I think that's what he will bring into this meeting, to try to convince Dr. Riek Machar to get him on board and put a government together of national unity. Now let's go to Machar. People around Machar are saying that Machar would be rejecting that proposal for a transition led by Kiir, that Machar is going to press more for a transition not led by Kiir, not led by himself. He would want to go for a transition led by a neutral group, okay, whether technocratic, whether faith-based, whether what.
Now, it's taken more than 4 months for the leader to meet. We're just wondering, why now and what is the motivation?
You have an international community and a region which is not prepared to spare anything in the arsenal to stop these things and not again have a genocide. There's pressure working on them in terms of sanctions, and there is the region, if the region particularly joins on the sanctions and tightens their assets and their property and their bank accounts and their movements and their families and so forth, if the region could support, then the results will become more faster.
And what are the implications of the eventual resolutions that come out of this meeting?
What can be achieved in one day's meeting? Not much. But the fact that if it produces follow-up action, that would be excellent. I think Uganda must be made to withdraw. Uganda must be made to toe the line and make its contribution within the regional framework, within the AU framework, within the UN framework. Then again, who are the spoilers on both sides must be mapped out quickly and must be put on notice and must be hunted down for, so that the region really moves forward. For the outcome of this meeting to become meaningful, okay, Ethiopia or Kenya must put in boots on the ground now or yesterday. And one of these countries should lead that effort, particularly Ethiopia, which has a lot at stake here because it is mediating the talks.
That's David Poulkol, a member of Civil Society Africa Security Network, speaking with Lucy Pony in Nairobi earlier today. Today is the second day of the month of tranquility both sides agreed at the start of the week. And so far, the truce appears to be holding. There are no reports of major clashes anywhere in South Sudan, including in towns that have seen heavy fighting in recent weeks. It was the UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Toby Lancer, who called for the month of tranquility. He says it is essential that the fighting stops in order to allow humanitarian aid agencies to get food and relief supplies to hundreds of thousands of people who have been forced to flee their homes since the fighting started 5 months ago. Earlier this week, President Salva Kiir said it is essential to avoid widespread famine in the country.
This is the time the rains come in our country and everybody runs to his or her field to sow something so that when the harvest time comes, you have something to harvest. Now this thing has not yet started and it will be a very serious disaster next time if we don't allow our people to cultivate now. and famine will be there.
That was President Salva Kiir speaking earlier this week about the importance of observing a 1 month of tranquility in South Sudan. The truce period began yesterday and so far is holding. Amnesty International says both sides in South Sudan's conflict have committed horrific atrocities against civilians. It says the attacks have been ethnically motivated and amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The rights group has released the results of its investigation called Nowhere Safe, Civilians Under Attack in South Sudan. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Africa, Michelle Kagari, says deliberately attacking civilians is a war crime.
We found consistently wherever we went, whether it was a conflict area where the government troops were in control or whether it was the armed opposition that were in control, civilians had been specifically targeted and they had been killed. We found evidence of abductions, evidence of rape, including rape of women who were pregnant and young girls, which is an additional crime.
She says there is also evidence of the killing of soldiers who had laid down their weapons and were no longer taking part in the fighting. Kagari says there are no safe havens, even in places typically considered sanctuaries.
We found that there was no regard whatsoever to the protection that these places have and that civilians were being targeted and killed in hospitals, in churches, and within the UNMISS bases. And all these are war crimes.
When fighting started last December, many observers, NGO officials, and international leaders refrained from calling it an ethnic-based conflict. But Kagari says a tipping point has been reached since then. She notes that South Sudan's own Human Rights Commission said earlier this year that the ethnic dimensions of the conflict cannot be ignored.
Certainly, when we went on the ground, that seemed to be the primary motivation for killings. So people were being killed on the basis that they were either Nuer or Dinka or Shilluk. And the political affiliation had certainly become secondary. And that would have been a shift maybe as opposed to when the conflict first started in December.
The Amnesty International report says civilians are frightened and traumatized.
We had one civilian tell us that South Sudan is destroyed. There's nothing left. Everything they have has been destroyed, which is another war crime. There has been deliberate looting and razing of villages. And the looting has been so widespread. One person told us that she left in advance of the pro-government forces. And when she went back, her house was completely cleaned. And this was pretty similar with everywhere else in that neighborhood.
Kagari says UN compounds are sheltering only a small number of South Sudan's displaced. If they leave those areas, they are subject to attack and gang rape. She says UNMISS forces lack the capacity to protect civilians just outside compound walls.
We would like UNMISS's mandate to change so that there's much stronger focus on protection of civilians. We would also like the Security Council resolution that was passed in December to be fully enforced so that UNMISS has the capacity to ensure protection of civilians.
Most of the hundreds of thousands of displaced South Sudanese are in the countryside.
They are not able to plant. Now, if they are not able to plant, they are not able to get their food, then really we're looking at famine being inevitable if they're not able to plant by the end of this month.
The rainy season is making many roads impassable, meaning food truck convoys cannot reach those in need. She says both the African Union and UN should investigate and document cases of potential war crimes. But evidence may be washing away.
We are concerned that with the rains, evidence of these crimes is being lost. We already found that a number of sites where there had been mass killings, bodies had already been buried and the evidence is already being lost. So we are really concerned that investigations should be expedited in order to ensure that there is accountability for these crimes.
Amnesty International says all parties to the conflict must immediately cease all violations of international human rights and humanitarian law, and allow unfettered access for humanitarian assistance to those in need. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan just released a new report today, backing Amnesty International. The report says both sides are guilty of committing human rights abuses. The report cites arbitrary arrest and detention, attacks against civilians, and sexual violence. From Juba, Philip Thorn-Aleu has more for VOA.
ONU's spokesperson, Ariane Kwantai, says today's report, a follow-up to an interim report published in late February, outlines even more violations on a much larger scale than previously recognized.
The violations that have been committed include extrajudicial killings, include raping of women, include forced displacement of people, include destruction of property, includes far too much killing and torturing.
Kwantai says other documented violations include attacks on UN peacekeeping bases, targeted attacks on civilians, and killings of patients in hospital beds. She says the manner in which the attacks were carried out suggests a strong degree of coordination and planning. She called on the AU to take action.
The report calls for a number of things. It calls for continuing documenting the grave violations that have taken place. It calls for having other organizations, such as regional organization, the African Union, to look into violations. It calls for accountability mechanism to be put in place, and it calls for an end of the violence.
Kwantai says at least 900 victims and witnesses of the violence were interviewed for the report. She says UNMISS does not have the mandate to determine the consequences for human rights abuses, but regional and international should make certain that the perpetrators are punished.
What will happen based on that is not up to the United Nations mission in South Sudan. It could come from countries, it could come from the Security Council, but it's not for UNMISS to decide.
Kwantai says UNMISS will continue to provide protection to civilians at its bases across the country, and its gates remain open to anyone believing the fighting. For BOA News, I'm Philip Thorn-Aleu in Juba.
The humanitarian group Oxfam is calling on United States to continue to pressure South Sudan government to end the conflict, which has displaced more than 1 million people and left more than 10,000 people dead. Oxfam officials want U.S. President Barack Obama to cut off all support to the South Sudan military. Andrew Green has the story for VOA from Juba.
Noah Gottschalk, Oxfam America's senior humanitarian policy advisor, applauded the U.S. government's decision on Tuesday to impose sanctions on two South Sudanese military leaders. The U.S. Treasury Department targeted Presidential Guard Commander Marial Chan Wong and opposition military leader Peter Gadet for threatening the peace, stability, and security of South Sudan.
In light of the gravity of the situation in South Sudan, there's a real need for the U.S. to do more to try to put an end to the conflict as well as to meet the needs of people who've been affected.
Gottschalk says the United States should go a step further and revoke a waiver it issued South Sudan under the Child Soldiers Prevention Act. The act prohibits the U.S. government from providing military aid to any country that uses child soldiers, except in instances where it supports U.S. national security. The act prevents the United States from providing education and training to soldiers from those countries or from providing foreign military financing. The United States does not provide military financing to South Sudan, but Gottschalk says rescinding the waiver would prevent other forms of military support, as well as succeed in sending a strong message.
This is one of the rare instances where a moral interest aligns with a geopolitical interest. With reports by the United Nations that up to 9,000 child soldiers have been newly recruited by both sides of the conflict. It's really important for the Obama administration to send a strong signal that this is absolutely unacceptable.
The White House issued its most recent waiver in October of last year. Gottschalk says the U.S. government should also consider more targeted sanctions, so long as they do not harm any civilians. And he says the international community should consider revising the mandate of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, so that there is no appearance of support to the government. He says this will help protect UNMISS's neutrality and allow it to focus on protecting civilians. For VOA News, I am Andrew Green in Juba.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Leaving your home in an emergency can be very disruptive, both emotionally and physically. The stress of relocation is especially hard on children, who naturally look to adults for answers to the new uncertainties in their lives. So if your family is in this situation, reassure your children that they're safe and that you will protect them. Let them talk about their feelings and establish a new routine for eating and bedtime. Playtime is important too. All these things can help a displaced child feel a bit better, knowing that the family will be able to one day regain control and get on with their lives.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Nigerians react to Mrs. Obama's Twitter message on the kidnapped schoolgirls. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who was your favorite teacher and what made him or her so good?
Well, it was Miss Turner in my primary school. And one thing that attracted me to her was the fact that she had a motherly figure.
My favorite teacher in school was my English teacher. He made me develop interest in English language.
My best teachers in school, they were in the Polytechnic. One of them taught me advertising. The other taught me film production.
My favorite teacher was the one taking me public policy and analysis.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. In Nigeria, women say they are proud that U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama is standing with them, a day after she tweeted a picture of herself holding up "Bring Back Our Girls" sign. But as Heather Maddock reports for VOA from Abuja, some security analysts fear the U.S. involvement could do more harm than good in effort to rescue more than 300 kidnapped girls.
Outside a busy conference room, Hauna Ali, a Nigerian journalist and mother, grins as she holds up her cell phone. Her new BlackBerry avatar is a picture of Michelle Obama holding up a sign that says, #BringBackOurGirls. Ali is near tears as she explains why.
It's just wonderful. Michelle doing it, you know, standing in the White House with the flag. It was just mind-boggling.
Even after 5 years of the Boko Haram insurgency that has killed thousands of people, the kidnapping of more than 300 girls nearly 4 weeks ago was a shock to Nigerians. Protests led by women broke out across the country, and online activists rallied around Twitter hashtags like "Bring Back Our Girls." Nigerians have never been louder about their demand for security, and Ali says Mrs. Obama's tweet proves they have finally been heard.
I think we now have this feeling that we're not alone in this fight. Women in Africa now have a voice, and our voice is being heard not just in Nigeria, but the whole world.
In the past 2 days, the United States, Britain, France, and China have offered assistance in finding the girls, and Nigeria has accepted. But the girls are believed to be held in a remote region, either controlled by or infested with well-armed militants who say they are holding the girls as slaves to be sold. Some security analysts fear that foreign involvement could do more harm than good. Ade Ogundeyin is the CEO of ProForce, a security company that builds armored cars and other military equipment. He says if the girls are rescued, it will only be with the help of local people who will not work with Western forces. A Western presence in northern Nigeria could also aggravate the fighting.
We have to be very, very careful. This is a typical Nigerian situation. And if anything is escalated, yeah, they could get the girls, but they may be all dead.
Boko Haram means Western education is sin, and Abubakar Shekau, the man who says he leads the group, regularly threatens to kill any Nigerian who associates with the West and Western leaders. Damiola Awesu, a Nigerian human rights lawyer, says the missing girls are not just a security issue, but a women's rights issue. Even before the kidnapping, most girls in northeastern Nigeria didn't go to school. She says it will be years before education levels for girls in the region will rise again even to minimal standards.
We want our children free. We want them to come back home. It's their right to live a life. It's their right to go to school. And the government has a responsibility to protect their rights.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has promised that the girls will be rescued and says they remain alive and healthy. But information is scarce, and he hasn't said how he knows anything about their condition or when they will be saved. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Pro-Russia militants in eastern Ukraine are expected today to discuss Russian President Vladimir Putin's call to delay a referendum on autonomy from the pro-Western government in Kiev. At the Kremlin yesterday, Mr. Putin recommended that separatists in eastern Ukraine postpone the secession vote set for Sunday. He also suggested publicly for the first time that Ukraine's May 25th presidential election, the target of recent Kremlin scorn, is now a move in the right direction. A massive explosion in a tunnel dug by rebel fighters destroyed an historic hotel facing Aleppo's iconic 13th century citadel. Both opposition and government sources in Syria are reporting numerous casualties among government troops being housed in that building. Amateur video shows an enormous mushroom cloud rising into the sky over Syria's largest city after a blast leveled the hotel. And finally, a roadside bomb in Pakistan's northwest has killed at least 9 military soldiers. Pakistani authorities said today's blast in North Waziristan's tribal agency was planted by terrorists. And that's a look at today's top story. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's all the time we had for you tonight. We now leave you with a song with a group from Sudan's Blue Nile State singing about peace. We have been listening to a group from Sudan's Blue Nile State singing about peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.